talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auch die Rollen, Argus, Akhoisa.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we're exploring the dramatic evolution of Sinn Féin from its roots in armed struggle to becoming a dominant political force in both Northern Ireland and the Republic. And we'll be debating whether the party will lead the next Irish government. You can email us your thoughts and views, talkinghistory@newstalk.com, and we'd love to hear from you. Tonight's show is on the history of modern Sinn Féin, charting its transformation from a party rooted in armed struggle to a major political force. We'll discuss its formation in 1970, all the way through its journey into mainstream politics, culminating in its recent successes in Northern Ireland and the Republic. As we discuss Sinn Féin's ideology, growth, and the prospects for leading the next government, we'll explore how the party has shaped and been shaped by modern Irish history. And to help me do this, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Professor Ines Mayo is the head of the School of Applied Language and Intercultural Studies at DCU, a leading expert on Sinn Féin. She's the author of Rebels in Government, Is Sinn Féin Ready for Power?, as well as the book New Sinn Féin, Irish Republicanism in the 21st Century. Dr. Brian Hanley is an assistant professor in the history of Northern Ireland at Trinity College Dublin, a leading expert on Irish republicanism and radicalism. He's the author of The Impact of the Troubles on the Republic of Ireland, Boiling Volcano, and the co-author of The Lost Revolution, The Story of the Official IRA and the Workers' Party. Dr. Liam Weeks is the head of the Department of Government and Politics at UCC, a leading expert on comparative politics and especially electoral systems, political parties and voting behaviour. He's the author of Independence in Irish Democracy, as well as two excellent co-authored books on the treaty. Dr. Matthew Whiting is Associate Professor in Politics at the University of York and has pioneered research on the intersection of conflict studies and comparative politics. And he's the author of Sinn Féin and the IRA, From Revolution to Moderation. And later in the show, I'll be talking to Lynn Boylan, the Sinn Féin MEP for Dublin. You're all very welcome. And yes, we might begin with you and a question about, the origins of Sinn Féin, or the date that we should use to talk about modern Sinn Féin. Is it 1970 when you see a split between what became official Sinn Féin and provisional Sinn Féin?
Well, that's a tricky question. I guess modern Sinn Féin could be traced back to 1970, but there's very little in common between the current party and the one that was born out of the split in 1970. So although they would claim that sort of legacy to an extent, I think modern Sinn Féin is really very closely associated with the peace process and with the Good Friday Agreement and the subsequent developments on both sides of the island.
So maybe talk to us about what happened in 1970, that because the fact that you did have two parties with the Sinn Féin name, why was there a split and what was the difference between them?
One of the key issues, or I should say two key issues, were abstentionism, where it was proposed by the leadership at the time that Sinn Féin elected representatives should take their seats, not just in Dáil Éireann, but also in Westminster. So that was obviously unacceptable to those who felt that these parliaments were not either not legitimate, which was the case of Dáil Éireann, or a foreign parliament, which was the case of Westminster. So that was one of the key issues. The other one was also how to address the rising tensions in Northern Ireland and what role should republicanism and the IRA play in the what was effectively developing on the streets of Northern Ireland. And there was major differences between those who felt that direct intervention was necessary and those who felt that while they still believed that there was a place for armed strategy, that it should be rethought and it should be within a broader front that would be open up to more political forces that would be aligned, not necessarily with traditional republicanism, but with left-wing movements. So you have a split between what was then almost caricatured as the right and the left, or traditionalist versus modernist. It was far more complex than that. The Sinn Féin, the provisional Sinn Féin that emerged in 1970, was quite traditional in the way in which it approached the core Republican principles, which were abstentionism and armed struggle. But it was also far more efficient in organizing on the ground, and it made headways in Northern Ireland in a way that official Sinn Féin was never capable of matching.
And Brian, that is, I suppose, the significant thing about tonight's show. In previous months, we've looked at the history of Fianna Fáil, we've looked at the history of Fine Gael, they do the series on political parties. But Sinn Féin is different because it's an all-Ireland party. It has electoral success in Northern Ireland, it has electoral success in the South. And so it's a kind of a different story that you have to tell, given that it's not just about what happens here in the South.
Yeah, and it's been shaped by partition. As much as Republicans denounce partition and obviously want a united Ireland, the modern Sinn Féin party has been shaped by different experiences, North and South. So, you know, very much in the 1970s and early 1980s, the experience of its activists in Southern Ireland would be very, very different to those in the North. And for a long period, those in the South were in the shadow of the North. And effectively, Sinn Féin for a long time was a support group for the Northern struggle. And that began to change in the 1980s. And there was a realisation by people like Gerry Adams and Danny Morrison and others in the leadership of the Republican movement in the North, that if they were to expand in the South, they would have to address Southern concerns. But Adams and others had looked at what official Sinn Féin had become, which was the Workers' Party. And they actually saw the Workers' Party in many ways as a template for expansion in the South by taking up issues, particularly in Dublin and other urban areas, issues which would have been addressed historically by the Labour Party or by others on the left, and building Sinn Féin in the South, not just as something concerned about the North, but also as an activist political party on the ground.
And Brian, it is kind of extraordinary that 30 years ago, Sinn Féin didn't have a single TD in Dáil Éireann. You have the election of Caoimhín na Caoilean in 1997, one TD. And I think you would have been a very brave person in 1997 to predict that by the time of the 2020 general election, Sinn Féin would be getting more first preference votes than anyone else and becoming the second largest party, and being widely predicted to be leading the next government. Now, things have changed in recent months, but still in with a very good chance of leading the next government. And that really is a dramatic transformation.
It is, yeah, and it's very linked to the peace process. I mean, modern Sinn Féin particularly, and north of the border as well, has been successful because of its association with a peace settlement. And this is the irony. The fact is, if the armed struggle was raging now as it had been in the 70s and 80s, Sinn Féin would not have any TDs. They would have a handful of councillors in the South, because simply while the armed struggle was taking place, there was a ceiling on Sinn Féin's support. That was apparent north of the border as well. I mean, Danny Morrison has said in the mid-1980s, when Sinn Féin began to progress in the North and was doing very well for a while, he said, "We were still meeting voters who said to us, I really like what you're saying, but I can't stand these bombs." So there was a realisation, unsaid at the time, that the armed struggle was actually a block on Sinn Féin's progress politically. And again, there's a famous phrase, the Armalite in the ballot box. Well, ultimately, leading Republicans realised that the Armalite was a hindrance to success at the ballot box. And in the South, you had very active local organisations in the 1980s. You had Christy Burke elected as a councillor in Dublin in the mid-80s. Sinn Féin very involved at a local level, particularly in the anti-drugs movement and so on. But there was very much a ceiling on that until the peace process and until Sinn Féin leaders became national figures. And the ceasefires and the association with a peace process are the key in many ways. And even when the debates go on about the IRA and its legacy, giving up the armed struggle has been the key, really, for Sinn Féin's success.
And Matthew, that brings us very nicely to the subtitle of your book, Sinn Féin and the IRA. It's From Revolution to Moderation. So how was it able to make that transition from revolution to moderation? Because you do have these dramatic events in the 1980s with the hunger strikes, the election of Bobby Sands as MP for Fermanagh and South Tyrone. You have Gerry Adams becoming president of Sinn Féin in 1983 and himself being elected an MP for Belfast West. That there are these political breakthroughs in the 1980s, but then you also have, as Brian was saying, all of these complications and problems because the armed struggle is still raging.
I think whenever Sinn Féin began to take part in elections in the 1980s and take them more seriously, they never necessarily had the end point of today in mind at that point in time. So in their initial participation in elections immediately following the hunger strikes, which were participated in purely in order to represent the hunger striking prisoners, it really was quite ambivalent. So alongside all this, following the seeming success of electing Bobby Sands in Northern Ireland and then two TDs to the Dáil in the Republic of Ireland off the back of the hunger strikes, there was a push within Sinn Féin to contest all future elections, but on an abstentionist basis. They also made it very clear that this was not going to diminish for the armed struggle. And it was really only when people in Sinn Féin began to see that that was harming vote shares, particularly in the Republic of Ireland, that we saw a gradual shift away to participating more and more in that political system. So they decided, and very controversially, initially proposed in 1985 to remove abstentionism in Northern Ireland. It was rejected at Ar Ardeisht that year, but then subsequently passed in 1986. And for many, this led to a split at the time within Sinn Féin, where for many critics from within the party, particularly the old guard, the Southern Conservative, saw this as de facto recognising partition and therefore participating in illegitimate political entity in the Republic of Ireland, and so stepped away. But for the rest of the Sinn Féin leadership, that's sort of now for Gerry Adams, for Martin McGuinness, these Northern nationalists, that allowed them to bring elections to being as important a part of the armed struggle going forward, pushing more towards elections.
And Matthew, when you talk about Gerry Adams, it is remarkable that he was president of Sinn Féin for 35 years, from 1983 until 2018, and oversaw really a quite dramatic transformation in its electoral fortunes and its very identity over those 35 years.
Absolutely. And what's also very interesting about the presidency of Sinn Féin is that they orchestrate it very well, so that it's never been contested. Nobody has ever run against them, and the person who runs to be president is always elected president. And I think Gerry Adams managed to position himself as being very important in shaping the direction of modern Sinn Féin, precisely because he came out as a very strong critic of Sinn Féin in the 1970s. He derided Sinn Féin in the 1970s as a form of spectator politics, of people talking about the ideals of United Ireland, but not offering any day-to-day policies to improve the positions of nationalists in Northern Ireland or nationalists in the Republic of Ireland. And so when he came along, he said, look, it's not just about the armed struggle, but we also need day-to-day policies that will improve the position of people's lives around housing, around education, around discrimination, around inequality. And off the back of this, was able to build quite a strong power base to reshape the party within his own image as much more of an everyday political movement, albeit while still retaining this long-term goal of a United Ireland. He was also seemingly a little bit more pragmatic. So we saw in the 1990s, he was willing to hold behind-the-scenes talks with the SDLP and with the British government, often unbeknownst to other people in Sinn Féin as well, only to a small coterie who knew about it. And through this process, began to shift his position somewhat on whether Northern Ireland could be reformed from within or whether it couldn't. And up to that point, they believed it couldn't, and that's why they didn't participate, but began to accept things like the principle of consent, that a majority of the people in Northern Ireland should democratically choose its future. And in this way, we see a gradual shift led by Adams, but also with strong support by the likes of McGuinness, to move towards a more political and perhaps a slightly more pragmatic version of the party as well.
Inés, when we talk about the political parties, we try to identify maybe the values or principles of the party and what they stand for. Is it possible to define Sinn Féin's values and principles? I suppose a central one would be a belief in a 32-county United Ireland. When it comes to economic policies, there's perhaps a belief that they're more on the left politically, more radical ideas when it comes to housing, healthcare. You also see maybe more of a scepticism when it comes to Europe, certainly up until maybe more recent years where it would have opposed various European treaties. Like, is it possible to define what Sinn Féin stands for and stood for over these years?
I think Sinn Féin, because it's constructed itself and its identity first and foremost in Northern Ireland, was always very closely associated with the working classes, and a lot of the leaders of that time of the 70s and 80s were from the working classes. So they had a good grasp of what the issues were at local level and at kind of grassroots level. And they were very good. They were always really good at having, you know, this approach to grassroots politics. Even then, they exported that to the Republic. And gradually, what you see in the 1980s is a shift towards left-wing politics. And a kind of a focus on bread and butter issues, as they call them at the time, and looking at issues such as housing, which becomes a key policy for Sinn Féin because also of the issues of segregation and discrimination in local housing. So they're looking at those issues. And there's no doubt that what we have now, the policies that we have now, are for some of them quite deeply rooted in, you know, left-wing policies of redistribution of income, of ensuring that the richer, the wealthier part of society pays for the less well-off sections of the community. So we have that very strong belief in left-wing politics in terms of housing, health. They are looking at making housing more affordable and at making healthcare more efficient by making it more accessible to especially those who are less well off. So we have that left-wing sort of policies. Where Sinn Féin doesn't really know where it stands is on issues that it hasn't really taken enough time to think about those issues, such as immigration. And I think this is going to be the defining issue in the next general election, and could also explain why the party is faring quite poorly at the moment. Obviously, compared to 2020, it's still quite strong, but it has dropped a considerable amount since 2020. And its knee-jerk reaction is to kind of try and address the issue of immigration by looking what is happening on the ground, and making a choice that is a risky choice, which is to pander to the more populist element of those voices that are heard at the moment regarding the issues of asylum and direct provision, etc. And I think this shows that somehow Sinn Féin still has quite a road to travel in terms of its rooting in a specific political ideology. And right now, it's still a movable feast. It does well on issues such as housing and health. It does less well on other issues. We need to remember that Sinn Féin has always been able to adapt. It's a party that knows how to lick its wounds when it has it suffers a major setback, like in 2019 when it fared so poorly in the local elections and in the EU elections, and it came back in 2020 with an outcome that surprised everyone, including themselves. So Sinn Féin doesn't give up and adapts, because that's what it always did. So Sinn Féin is good at constructing a narrative and at adapting to new situations. Right now, the call that they have made, I think, is risky on immigration because that could lose them a number of votes because they're left-wing leaning on issues, on social issues. But on immigration, they're not too sure where they stand. And this could lose them the votes of those who are genuinely left-wing leaning and are less strict on immigration than the major political parties are at the moment.
Liam, fascinating there to hear that description and a word that was used, populist, and that's a charge that's often levelled at Sinn Féin by its opponents, that it's a populist party. It says what it thinks will appeal to the largest number of people. And how valid is that criticism?
I mean, from that perspective, many parties could be called populist, Patrick. I mean, I think Fianna Fáil was famously called a classically populist party. If you think from an international perspective, one of the issues with populism, it's a label that can be difficult to pin down and it can just be thrown willy-nilly at different types of parties. But from a more European perspective, which is where we think about populism and its roots in the 1930s and previously, it very much focuses on an us against them argument. So we think about there's us, the grassroots people versus the elites. The kind of populism you'd have heard used by Trump in America, used during the Brexit campaign in the UK. And that we would hear that type of language very much so amongst Sinn Féin. But one issue where Sinn Féin is different from European populism, which relates to the European Union and migration. So populist parties all across Europe are very much, if not Eurosceptic, pretty much anti-European Union membership. And they're also quite vehemently anti-immigrant. And those two issues are not issues that Sinn Féin, the party itself, its supporters may, but it's the party as an organisation do not lay claim to. Now, again, that hasn't always been the case. We know that Sinn Féin campaigned, along the Labour Party and other parties, it should be said, campaigned against EEC membership. I remember even when I was an undergraduate in the 90s, Sinn Féin, this small organisation in university, campaigned against EU treaties. So I think the party uses the term, it's become more Eurocritical. So from that perspective, it would be different to the populist parties. But Agnes certainly touched on an excellent point regarding immigration. This is a huge conundrum for Sinn Féin because populist parties, this is what has led to the recent growth of populist parties across Europe. It's becoming one of the biggest issues at general elections, whether it was Austria very recently or the UK previously and so on. And Sinn Féin doesn't know what to do because of Sinn Féin's roots in anti-imperialism, etc., anti-colonialism. That's why they are pro-migration. And while cynics would, be quick to attack political parties, in fairness to Sinn Féin, from a purely cynical point of view, if they wanted to maximise their votes based on where public opinion lies, they could have taken a hardline stance against immigration at the recent local elections. Because we see from opinion polls, like we're talking about two-thirds to three-quarters of Irish people feel that there's too many immigrants in society. They question what value immigrants have brought to Irish society, regardless of the normative value of those statements. So there is a populist sentiment from that perspective amongst the electorate, which Sinn Féin hasn't tapped into. And from their perspective, it's because it's not an ideology many within Sinn Féin organisation don't subscribe to. So, I mean, even going back 20, 30 years, when we looked at why people originally began to vote for Sinn Féin, there was this anti-establishment, anti-migrant position amongst our supporters, but not amongst the voters. So it's a difficult one for Sinn Féin because while, yes, there has been, it is part of this populist surge, but I think Sinn Féin doesn't want to be seen as purely just a populist party. As you've discussed in terms of its origins, it does, like populist parties are often accused of being chameleonic and lacking a clear ideology. And based on its traditional nationalist and ideological roots, you certainly couldn't call Sinn Féin that.
And Liam, you're an expert on political parties, voting behaviour, elections. And looking at, the four most recent elections in the South, Sinn Féin went from four seats to 14 to 23 to 37. And I wonder when you look at its rise in, say, the last 10, 15 years, Are they taking support that would maybe before that have gone to Fianna Fáil? Is it that voters who became disillusioned with Fianna Fáil after the crash then switched to Sinn Féin? Was it that they were taking it from independents and other groupings? I'm not really able to understand where its rise came from and who it was maybe taking support away from.
I think you're not the only one, Patrick, who is struggling to pin down exactly. And let's be honest, Sinn Féin themselves don't exactly know where this support is coming from. That's why in 2020, they made the mistake of not running enough candidates. That's why at the 2024 local elections, they made the mistake of running too many candidates. And because, let's be honest, 2020 was a huge shock to everyone. They had performed poorly at the 2019 local elections. And also, Leon Arida had really performed poorly at the presidential elections. Peter Casey, with no organisation, got a vote far larger than the Sinn Féin vote. Really, Patrick, they're picking up votes in 2020 from everywhere. When the support has been that large and the increase was that considerable, they're picking up votes from everywhere. I wouldn't say they're picking up votes from the independents because the independents have been growing. What I would say is, we think about Sinn Féin as a relatively new party from the perspective of the Dáil. The history of small and new parties in Irish politics has been pretty much the same pattern for them all. They start well and then they fade off into oblivion. But for Sinn Féin, it's been the opposite. You mentioned it's been a very gradual incremental rise. So in 97, you mentioned they got one seat. In 2002, they got five. In 2007, they fell back to four. But even in 2011, Patrick, which was, you know, the nadir when people, as you mentioned, were leaving Fianna Fáil, Sinn Féin still only got one in 10 votes. So it's just been a steady, slow rise. It's just the 2020 thing that has kind of shocked people in terms of the volatility of the electorate. Looking at the election studies, we can see that support for them has actually come from everywhere, from people who used to vote for Labour. What might surprise people, it's also come from people who used to vote for Fine Gael as well. What it's an indication of, Patrick, is really that we have a very volatile electorate and that people were looking for change. We saw this previously, but if you wanted to vote for change, who was the only option? The only option really in 2020 in terms of a new party was Sinn Féin. I think it also reflects that the electorate has moved slightly to the left, considering in the past this was one of the reasons given why the Labour Party struggled. We can see from looking at opinion polls and looking at support for various types of policies, the Irish electorate has definitely become more liberal-leaning, definitely more left-leaning. And so from that perspective, Sinn Féin has been sweeping up votes that would previously have gone to Labour. Maybe that the smaller parties like Social Democrats might have picked up if Sinn Féin wasn't there. But to rise to that particular level really indicates they are getting votes from everywhere.
When we're still dealing with the outcomings of the 2009 crash. I mean, the political system here has been shaken since that period. And Labour going into government in 2011-2012 has had a massive impact on Sinn Féin's growth, really, because they have become the alternative to a long succession of Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil coalitions. I mean, we've had the same combination of parties in power for over a decade. And that has benefited Sinn Féin, I think, particularly among the young.
Well, we are talking history, and tonight we are talking about the history of modern Sinn Féin. We're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, I'll be talking to Lynn Boylan, MEP for Dublin, Sinn Féin representative and politician, of course, and we'll be talking about why she joined Sinn Féin and their vision for the future. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're talking history. Tonight we are, of course, talking about the history of Sinn Féin, and I'm delighted to be joined by Lynn Boylan, MEP for Dublin and a member of Sinn Féin. Lynn, you're very welcome.
Thank you for having me on.
So when you joined Sinn Féin, why did you do it? Was it because of the history that interested you, or was it because of their policies?
So I joined, I think it was 2005 or 2006 when I joined, and I did join because I was particularly interested in history growing up and did history for my leaving cert and really interested in the Irish question. And so Sinn Féin appealed to me from that sense. But I also didn't come from a political family. So it was never a case of this is a Sinn Féin household or this is a Fianna Fáil household, Fine Gael household. We were more or less sort of shown how to fill in a ballot sheet. And then my dad would have said to me, go off and have a look at the political parties and see which one kind of identifies with your own views. So I had always voted for Sinn Féin ever since I had my first vote. But then in 2005, 2006, I was living in Kerry and got to know a couple of the Sinn Féin activists down there. And I was kind of criticising them that they weren't active enough on the ground. So they put a membership form through my door and said, either join or shut up. Stop hassling us on a Friday evening. But it was particularly, I think, the United Ireland question. You know, because I had done my Leaving Cert, you know, you do your special essay. I had done that on Michael Collins and his time in Fran Gach and how I suppose he'd learned that, you know, the 1916 Rising wasn't the approach to take. So that was really the first appeal. And then I liked their social policies as well when you started doing a bit more investigation into the party.
And when you joined the party, of course, it was, you know, the decade after the peace process and the Good Friday Agreement and all of that. But in that earlier period then, would you have been uncomfortable with the fact that there also was a military conflict going on?
I think, look, nobody wanted the conflict, and nobody wanted the conflict to go on any longer than was necessary. So as you said, I joined the party after the Good Friday Agreement and the peace process. And I'm that generation that thankfully, you know, don't really remember growing up in the conflict. But I suppose we have, if you look at all the political parties in Ireland, bar probably the Greens, there's every party has its own history in terms of, because that's the nature of the country. We had to fight for our freedom, and we still don't have the full freedom of the island. So we still have the six counties to win back.
What would you see as the core values of Sinn Féin?
I think the core values, and that's what appealed to me, was republicanism and that idea of, you know, equality for citizens. The proclamation still stands today. I always say, like, the proclamation is as valid today as it was when it was written in 1916. So it is those republican core values that I ascribe to, and still to this day would like to try and uphold in everything that you do. I think if you keep your, I suppose, your eye on those values, then you can't go too far wrong. They should be your guiding principles.
This is a history show, so I feel I have to ask you about the work you did championing the Stardust families. And I was watching the Dáil session when there was the state apology, and I remember seeing you going up and hugging the families. And I know that you had played such an important role campaigning for them. How significant do you think that historical event was?
Incredibly significant. You know, it was a stain on Irish society and how those families were treated for 43 years. I mean, I was 5 at the time of the fire. I had a cousin who would have been a regular attending at the Stardust, was there that night, but thankfully wasn't injured. But also, just, you kind of grew up, I think anybody from that generation, like, even though I was very, very young, when you started going out, your parents would tell you, always make sure you know where the fire exits are. If there is a fire in the building, leave everything behind. So it kind of, the ripple effect, you know, stayed over the decades. But just when you look at how those families were treated and how they've had to fight tooth and nail and go and get all of the evidence themselves, I mean, you can't help but be, I suppose, in awe of their strength and the ability to keep going. The state apology was very, very welcome, and it came fast, at least on the back of the inquest, but they shouldn't have had to fight for 43 years. And, you know, you're looking now at the Creaslock families are saying they don't want to be in the same position. So I think we've a lot to learn from how the state treated the families.
But you campaigned, and that seems to be something that you enjoy, or it's part of your approach as politics. You take on these causes and issues, you campaign. I think you see that as a crucial part of the role.
I love that. I mean, how the Stardust families found me was because I had campaigned for Ibrahim Halawa's release in Egypt. And they were sort of saying, well, you know, can you do something similar or help us? Because the campaign has sort of hit a brick wall and they were really looking for just new ideas. And I think that it's something that you're very privileged to be in politics. I mean, when the people elect you and they give you that platform, you should use it for good. And one of the things you can do, certainly as an MEP, is to elevate those issues and to try and just, you know, help families, help those causes. And it's something that I really, really enjoy. And I suppose it goes back to, again, as to why you get involved in politics. It's about social justice. It's about trying to help people. But it is a particular area that I really, really enjoy, is campaigning and those battles when people think that, you know, oh, it's that's never going to happen. They're never going to get justice. He's never going to get out of prison. I think, you know, you just have to keep going and use the platform that you have.
You're a very active member of the European Parliament. This is your you were there 2014 to 19, then a senator, and then re-elected now this summer and back again. But Sinn Féin is sometimes seen, and very often seen, as a somewhat Eurocritical, Eurosceptical party. It has campaigned against various referendums in the past. So how do you kind of align your own work as an MEP with Sinn Féin being seen perhaps as an anti-European party?
I always find it odd that when people say you're anti-EU, we think we're EU critical. And the thing is that nobody would question someone who would go, even if they vote for this government and they're going like, this government, I voted for them, but I actually don't like this bit of what they're doing. I don't like that they can't fix the housing crisis. So I think it is bizarre when you, as an MEP or as a political party, that you go, look, there's parts of the EU that have been very good for Ireland in terms of gender equality, in terms of some of the environmental issues, certainly, like we have, you know, we're a country that had to be dragged fighting and kicking in terms of environmental policy. So I think there's areas where it goes, that makes absolute sense that we cooperate at an EU level, or that we pool our resources in that sense. But there's also areas where I think it's really important that we retain our sovereignty, and that's neutrality, foreign policy. I think there are areas that we should be able to decide, you know, at the ground level by the people. We're very proud of our neutrality historically, so we shouldn't be pooling our lot in with countries who have different historical backgrounds and different reasons for not being neutral. So I think that's the approach we take. We look at every piece of legislation on its merit and whether or not that decision should be taken at a much closer level in Ireland, or whether it makes sense to do that at an EU level. So in terms of the treaties, they were all about handing extra power over to the European Union. I mean, if you look, we handed over the ability to negotiate trade agreements in the Lisbon Treaty. Now we're seeing all of the backlash about the Mercosur agreement and how damaging it would be for agriculture in Ireland. We gave away that power, so we would say we were vindicated in fighting against it. Likewise with the fiscal treaty, our hands are tied in terms of state investment, and we warned that that would happen. So I think that that's the approach we take, is that, you know, let's look at each piece on its merit. And I think that's how people approach their national government. It shouldn't be any different with the European.
Have you been surprised at the electoral success of Sinn Féin over the past number of decades? Like, we've been talking on the show about how, you know, no TDs before 1997, one TD elected then, you know, 37 elected in the last election, and people talking about the possibility of Mary Lou MacDonald becoming Taoiseach. She wasn't even included in the first leaders' debate last time out, and then there was a backlash and you know, a possible possibility of Sinn Féin leading the next government. That really has been a quite extraordinary trajectory.
It has, and I think people were equating, was it the 19, which election was it that was also held in February, that Sinn Féin was in 1918, had a really, really good election when it was held on a Saturday. I think it was the last time there was a general election held, and the last election where we had, I suppose, our most successful election in recent history. I think the thing within Sinn Féin that I really like is, one, that we decide our policy at a member level. So at our DESH every year, it's members who bring forward the policy and vote for it. But I also think that we've had, particularly like initially under Gerry Adams, who is the leader of the party for a very long time, and now under Mary Lou, is that sort of long game vision. There's no point in, you know, fast wins and then you lose them again. It's that we have a long game. The long game is a united Ireland, a more equal Ireland, not just tacking the six counties onto the 26. So that's always been the game in the way that we have set out our trajectory, is build and build and build and continue to build. And when you get elected, make sure you remain rooted and relevant in your communities, and you build on that. So if you get councillors elected, that builds towards a general election. So I think that's been the way we've approached elections, certainly as long as I've been in the party. I hope it continues in that trajectory. I hope we build on the election of 2020. And I would love to see Mary Lou as Taoiseach, not just because she'd be the first female Taoiseach, but I also think that she's been an incredible ally, certainly to other women in the party, and encouraging us to you know, step forward to have gender equality in terms of the ballots and all of that. So I think she would make a fantastic Taoiseach. Taoiseach.
And yet, even if the election had been held in 2022, we probably would have Mary Lou as Taoiseach. But now the more recent opinion polls are suggesting that that's not looking as the certainty that it once was. So is that understandable to you why there has been this apparent shift?
Look, I think it's been difficult for us. I mean, it's been a difficult year personally for Mary Lou MacDonald. I mean, she's had a lot to deal with over the last 12 months and she's been open about that. But I also think it doesn't do any harm to keep you on your toes. You should never take the electorate for granted because when you do, if you become complacent, I think then that backfires on you. So I think it's happening now. It's prior to the election. So it's a wake-up call for all of us that, we need to get our message out there more clearly and resonate with people. We are the only party that has an alternative housing plan when it comes to, looking at what the government have done 14 years in government and everything, every metric in housing is going in the wrong direction. So I think it's all to play for. But certainly, I think that the poll results has been a little bit of a wake-up call for all of us, and that's not a bad thing.
Do you think the botched RIC commemoration actually played into Sinn Féin's success in the last election? Because people were so riled up and enraged by it, and it did kind of create a nationalistic groundswell that probably didn't hurt you in the election.
I don't think it hurt us. I think it certainly hurt Fine Gael for even considering running it. I was down in West Cork in the January when that was announced, and just meeting people, it was the topic of conversation. People were furious about it. And I remember thinking, this is a bit strange. This is wider than just a Republican thing or a Sinn Féin thing. This is really touching a nerve with people. But I think in the wider context as well, there's something happening within Ireland around sort of that growing pride in our culture. And it's not like that sort of, I suppose, really narrow-minded nationalism that you can see sometimes probably in our closest neighbour, unfortunately. But I think like when you see the Irish language and the movement there, NECAP have done incredible work in that. But also like the growth in the likes of Lancome, the Mary Wallopers, all of these wonderful bands that are out there. And I think there's a huge amount of pride in our culture and arts. And I think that's a good thing as well. And all of that is playing into it. So I think the RIC was probably just like, what would you call the lightning rod? But I think there's a wider thing happening among our young people that they're, standing, looking, going around. There's nothing, no harm in being proud of Irish culture.
My final question will be a prediction. I won't ask you whether you think Sinn Féin will be leading the next government, but I will ask you whether you think unification will happen in our lifetime.
Oh, absolutely. I really do think it'll happen. I think when you see the likes of Leo Varadkar talking about preparing for a referendum, it shows you the direction of travel. I mean, Brexit clearly was a game changer. And even when now that we have, I suppose, a different British government, that hopefully we will have a better relationship with our neighbours under a Labour government. I think that's it's making sense to people a lot more now as to why would we have two systems on this very small island. There is a body of work to do to reach out to unionist communities to make sure that they feel welcome in a united Ireland. But I think it's inevitable that it's going to happen. And I think the united Ireland, and then we'll have an independent Scotland.
My thanks to, we'll have to do another show then, a Talking History special on that, on Scottish independence. My thanks to Lynn Boylan, MEP for Dublin and member of Sinn Féin Party. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And we'll be back with more on the history of Sinn Féin right after this. Welcome back. We're Talking History, and tonight we are debating the history of Sinn Féin. I'm rejoined by my brilliant panel of experts, Professor Ines Mayo, the head of the School of Applied Language and Intercultural Studies at DCU, who's the author of Rebels in Government, Is Sinn Féin Ready for Power? Dr. Brian Hanley, assistant professor in the history of Northern Ireland at Trinity College Dublin and a leading expert on Irish republicanism and radicalism. Dr. Liam Weeks, the head of the Department of Government and Politics at University College Cork and an expert on comparative politics and electoral systems. And and Dr. Matthew Whiting, Associate Professor in Politics at the University of York, who's pioneered research on the intersection of conflict studies and comparative politics. And his books include Sinn Féin and the IRA, From Revolution to Moderation. And just before the break there, we were talking to Lynn Boylan, the Sinn Féin MEP for Dublin. Matthew, can we talk then about the current, I suppose, leadership of Sinn Féin, where you have Mary Lou MacDonald, you have Michelle O'Neill in Northern Ireland, both of them very dynamic leaders, popular leaders. They're definitely seen as offering something different to the electorate.
Yeah, I think so. In part, I think that's probably because unionism is in such a crisis at the moment that any political party looks quite successful next to the DUP and the UUP at the moment. But I think what's really interesting, one of the challenges for Sinn Féin after they went through the peace process was that they positioned themselves or justified the peace process as saying we are now going to work within the existing parliaments, but we're going to do so still to pursue a united Ireland. And the way we're going to do that is by trying to build an all-Ireland dynamic. We're going to try and become the biggest party on both sides of the border. And one of the challenges that they've faced that initially seemed to work quite well is their vote share initially was rewarded immediately after the peace process. But one of the challenges that we've seen faced in more recent years is coordinating policy and coordinating leadership and coordinating personalities in either electorate and sort of making that appear coherent. So the type of policies that they need to respond to in Northern Ireland can be quite different than the type that they need to respond to in the Republic of Ireland. The dynamics of politics are obviously very different in Northern Ireland than they are in the Republic of Ireland. We see Michelle O'Neill navigating that extremely well, as I say, by positioning herself in a very leadership type role, by rising above the fray somewhat in terms of rather getting involved in everyday battles with unionism, stepping back and showing that they're ready for leadership. Whereas in the Republic of Ireland, it's been a lot more challenging for Mary Lou MacDonald.
And Liam, after the next election, you could see governments being formed in many different ways. You could have a continuation of the current arrangements. But if Sinn Féin are in power, the left-leading coalition that they would like to lead may not be possible based on the current figures. And they may have to go in to power with someone like Fianna Fáil, even though Sinn Féin criticises both Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael for a century of mismanagement. And Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael say that they won't go in with them.
Well, this is the critical issue, Patrick. I mean, it should be said Sinn Féin has not ruled out coalition with either Fine Gael or Fianna Fáil, whereas Fine Gael have certainly ruled out coalition with Sinn Féin. But we cannot say for certain in relation to Fianna Fáil. Yes, Micheál Martin, the Fianna Fáil leader, has said he's ruled out coalition, but there are many within Fianna Fáil who would actually welcome, probably I'm going to say welcome a left-wing coalition with Sinn Féin, because there are many with, you know, Fianna Fáil is a fairly broad movement, as they would say. You know, there are many within the party who might prefer the party to have a more left-leaning position. So Micheál Martin may have to do what Trevor Sargent did for the Greens in 2007 when they entered coalition with Fianna Fáil, when Trevor Sargent stood down as leader, but the party, because he was against the idea of coalition. What we, generally speaking though, Patrick, what is tend to going to happen is the elections are becoming less decisive. So in 2016, it took 50 days to form a government. In 2020, it took 100 days to form a government. Next time around, we literally don't know. It would really going to depend on the numbers. If you think about the last massive change in the party system, our last big surprise in terms of government formation, possibly 1989, when it was only 4 years since the Progressive Democrats had split away to form away from Fianna Fáil, and Haughey and O'Malley came together. And why did they come together? Not because they liked each other, obviously, but it was down to numbers. So, I mean, we can talk about the ideology, we can talk about policy. Numbers are going to dictate, Patrick, what government really is formed at the next election. And a question would be, if Sinn Féin did want to form, if you want to call it a left-leaning government, but essentially a government, a new government, without Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael, people will probably call it something like the makeshift majority that was formed in 1948, that was all about getting Fianna Fáil and Dev out. But this time, it will be all about really getting Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael out. Many, of course, would then raise the question, well, how would it work? How many parties are going to be involved? Would they have to bring in independents, etc.? In some ways, Sinn Féin, could face a position akin to the Communist Party in both Italy and France in the Cold War, Patrick, used to be often the largest party at elections, but the other mainstream parties said no to them. So that is going to be the issue for Sinn Féin. What is going to be the position of Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael? The position for Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael would be easy if the two of them win close to a majority between them. But if they don't, that then is going to... And also, because there will also be the moral question. There will be the moral question of if Sinn Féin finish first again, can Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael go back to the electorate and say, look, we don't want this party, who you prefer more than us, we don't want them in government. And, you know, then there might have to be changes within maybe the leadership of potentially Fianna Fáil for such a coalition to happen or to evolve. But as I said, it really goes back to my original point. It really will depend on the numbers and nothing else.
Brian, does history matter? Because I wonder if we had sample five potential voters for Sinn Féin here and ask them why they're going to vote for Sinn Féin, I don't think they would talk about the 1970s. You know, they may reference the peace process, but really they're concerned about present day issues, housing, healthcare, all these different issues. I don't think maybe the history of the party is such a significant feature for them.
Their history is important to their membership. But history is also important because I think the trump card in some ways in the way that Sinn Féin would be able to sell even a coalition with Fine Gael, which people always rule out, but I think Liam is right, I don't think he can rule anything out, is that it would be part of a progress to United Ireland. I mean, Sinn Féin can always say that ultimately they are the only party who is serious about reunification. And that issue would have been abstract for a long time, but it's not abstract anymore. And again, I think it's very significant that we will be dealing with that over the next, you know, period. And Sinn Féin can argue that, you know, being in power in Dublin and in power in Belfast makes transition to United Ireland much more likely. And I think that is very important for them. And it is important to a chunk of the electorate, certainly, that wants a bigger vision and that can believe maybe that health service, that housing and all these things would be better in a 32-county population.
Ines, that I think is a very significant point, that after the next election you could have Sinn Féin in government both north and south. They could be the largest party both north and south. And that has to be hugely significant and meaningful. But I think it also maybe raises the pressure then on Mary Lou McDonald, because this really does mean the pressure is on her to do well in that election, because otherwise, if Sinn Féin aren't in power in the south, you could perhaps see a change of direction and maybe a change of leadership.
I think what would be interesting in that scenario is that you would have two coalition governments on both sides of the island. And what Sinn Féin has shown in the north, by being in the Northern Ireland executive, is that it can accommodate different opinions and it can share power. And it's probably far more difficult to share power with the DUP than it would be with Fianna Fáil and even with Fine Gael. Obviously, right now, there's a huge amount of pressure on Mary Lou McDonald because she did so well in 2020 and because for the next 3 years, they were so high in the polls and she was also very popular as a leader. So right now, there's a huge amount of pressure on Sinn Féin and on Mary Lou McDonald to find a strategy that will make them, that will regain popularity amongst their voters. But obviously, if we have that kind of scenario where we have Sinn Féin in power, even though they will be in a coalition, then that does raise the issue of the United Ireland, which is at the core of everything that Sinn Féin does.
Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to Marisa Sullivan, my producer, and Peter Malloy on sound. We've got more debate and discussion next week, so hope you can join us then. We've been Talking History. Good night.